Percy James is one I can remember.
Well,
someone,
one thing was,
from behind the hills and down the billabong.
When
the
I started
plains. That was very free
doing
wool.
Some wool classing.
Very free wool. You couldn't pick it
I
up
started
and
with a
throw
priest.
It. Not like a short
I did
wool.
One in 4 minutes.
It all depends
myself.
On the owner.
But it had
you
no
go
belly
right
wool
through it. The shearer
or
gets a pen
around the head.
Sheep.
This is Sean O'Brien for Art Talk. I'm at the Carriage Works Performance Space site to see the exhibition Homeland Illuminations by the artists Ruark Lewis and Jonathan Jones. And this morning I'm talking to the artist Ruark Lewis. Good morning, Ruark.
Hello.
Now, Ruark, let's go through this work, find out a bit about it. Can you tell us, first of all, just describe to us what the work is? It's an installation. What does it consist of?
It consists of three elements. The major elements are a set of fluorescent tubes underneath a bank of 40 boards that are located on the floor. So it's a very low groundwork. It's a flat work on the ground, and it's 40 boards that make up about 7 meters by 5 meters squarish type of thing on the ground in two rows. So the boards are about 2 meters, 2.5 meters long each one. So 20 rows of each boards, and then there's a small collage, or a more discrete work, is an audio piece that attaches to the work, which is sort of like the narrator. Yeah, that's basically makes up the work, three different elements. We try to work in threes, sets of three things.
Okay, and the text that's in on both the boards that are on the floor and in the sound piece, where are you drawing that text from?
That's an oral history that Jonathan Jones has recorded from his grandfather, Raymond Bottrell. Raymond's about 82 years old, so he's not very well at the moment, and Jonathan and he have been working on oral histories. We've inscribed the parts of the oral history on the boards on the ground of the installation, a type of modified text. The entire text is actually on the audio work as well. But the recording of the text was manual, so it wasn't an audio recording of Raymond speaking. We've been very interested in how, I guess, the Chinese whispers occur, where Jonathan would transcribe his grandfather's tales and stories about being a wool classer in, I guess, 1930s. Yeah. Raymond's ancestry is Wiradjuri and Garimilaroi from an area down, I guess, the inner western ranges between Baraba and Bathurst, where his families would have lived in the good old days. Raymond's and Jonathan's ancestry come from that area. And the idea of the work is that you actually walk around the timbers on the floor and articulate the parts from that from the boards in two different lines, they're two different sizes of font, but it's what I call a peripatetic work. So you have to actually, we choreographed it so that people would move around it, and rather than be a passive artwork, that there's some interactive ways in and out of the work. We've got the audio recording also that gives you a sort of a narrative that walks you all the way through the entire text.
There they were
the
sent
off. The machine
can't handle so many bales,
the short wool,
and such
with the long wool.
They had to
the
satisfy
time,
themselves. The long wool
of what they wanted
can't run
with the short wool.
Their machines could sort it.
He was telling me
the wool shearing record that still stands
that they were looking at placing,
I think, was made with hand shears.
Priests into
the ones they hold and cut.
Every trade,
they held the record for shearing.
To go a little bit deeper into the work, into the themes, I guess in a way you're exploring the historical impact of colonial and Aboriginal Australia and some of its consequences. Would that be right?
Well, we began in a range of different ways. We were trying to get an authentic text, and you know, as soon as you start to go out searching for authenticity, it sort of becomes this sort of needle in a haystack sort of approach, and I had made a work earlier called Raft, and I'd stumbled upon a literary source, and a lot of my work has been around transcribing a source and transcribing it in the sense that it would bring it in from a literary or an anthropological or ethnographer into a public zone, bring it out of its covers, so to speak, and expose it. And when Jonathan invited me to work with him on this project, I was hoping, well, I came in as a transcriber for initially, and I'd worked on Aboriginal texts from Hermannsburg in Central Australia on the Raft project, and working on a history of translations that occurred on an Arrernte water myth. So when I came to work with Jonathan, I thought we're always working on these strategies of place and the politics of place. But we went back and we looked at some biblical texts that were translated first off in about the 1850s by Ridley, and who was a missioner in Western New South Wales, and we found some graphic texts that were created in a biblical format for the New Testament. And well, I didn't think that was a very interesting sort of... I think it was a very interesting text, but it was a very interesting graphic work. But I thought we couldn't... I didn't know how we could incorporate these things into it. I was still going back for this idea of the source. So we worked a little bit around R.H. Matthews, who's another ethnographer and recorder of Aboriginal communities in Western New South Wales. And again, there was nothing very directly linked to Baraba or Bathurst or Raymond's family. So we're trying to go back to that source again. So I was always curious, sort of needle in the haystack sort of process, but which we overcame by just going to the source itself. And Raymond was really forthcoming with his sense of place and sense of his childhood. But when he started to talk about his training as a young man, becoming a professional, I realised that Raymond's world had passed into Anglo-Australian economic society, and that as a wool classer, he had certain access into a place a lot of Aboriginal people didn't probably go. And I was interested in that sustainability issue.
I mean, just to put this into context for some of our international listeners, for instance, the idea of an Indigenous Aboriginal man in that time period, early, mid-20th century, in New South Wales and Australia, for an Aboriginal man to cross over into mainstream rural white culture is a very unusual thing, isn't it?
Well, it might have happened in the armed forces if in the First World War and the Second World War, people crossed over. But I guess in New South Wales, because Raymond would have passed as a white person, you know, he had blonde hair and, you know, there was a sudden... maybe his cousins were darker. And so there's the issue of just really a skin colour that it couldn't operate so freely. And there was, you know, enormous, you know, institutional discrimination going on in Australia, the apartheid system, which we never talk about. Was really a distinguishing factor between economic prosperity of Aboriginal communities and white communities. So the economy of Australia was very much a rural industries in those early 19th century and the 20th century up to about, you know, manufacturing booms in the late 50s. But in the early 20th century, the rights of Aboriginal people were really restricted. The economic rights were really restricted, and I think it's... perhaps it's not that bad today because everyone's observing it very, very closely, and there are a lot of people in the old days. I don't think everything happened quite quietly on the side, and wages and rights were, I don't know, it was a strange sort of environment, Australia. I didn't live there in Australia those days, but the records show enormous discrimination going on. But I guess that happens in colonial zones all over the world. And we can see histories of that in Malaysia or in Singapore or in India.
Your work is going on public display at this period, or your work that deals with the crossover or relationships between Indigenous and white Australia is going on public display at a time when we the current government has brought in the National Emergency Response Bill, which in its own way rolls back Aboriginal self-determination, you know, by centuries perhaps. How do you feel about dealing with Aboriginal white Australian concepts in your work at this particular time in our culture?
Well, I could be really literal about this and say there's very little that's white in the work. We chose five different colours as our spectrum: white, grey, black, a lot of grey. Maybe that represents a type of cosmopolitanism, I don't know, or a multiculturalism, that sort of grey zone in the space in between. And then we use the colours red and yellow as a sort of, that's the ground for which we put the articulation of the shepherd's story onto the boards. And so I as an artist, I work, and I encourage all artists to do this, to work in a sort of literary, allegorical way, so that the political can, or the social, or the aesthetic, artistic things can be wedded together. I keep thinking that there are three different ways an artist can work effectively, and that's working with philosophy, poetics, and politics, and that if we put at least 1% of any of those in the blend, we'll probably get a work which has got resonances there that people can then read to some degree the signals and the signs themselves, rather than dictate really the outcomes. So when I look at a bill in the Australian Parliament, I don't think I can transcribe a bill from the Australian Parliament effectively, because I think I would prefer that the poetics dominate the artwork. I mean, a child could come and have a look at that work and get an enormous value and be gratified from, you know, learning something about how you pull sheep's wool apart. I mean, it doesn't need to be a political thing, but maybe the artist inscribes more into it than it needs to have sometimes. And in this issues here, we, I mean, if you think of it from a physical point of view, there's a piece of wood floating on the ground with light pushing it up into the air. The work changes over the day; it becomes darker, and during the day it becomes lighter. In the middle of the day, the light pouring out of it makes it almost go white. So we've got these sort of changes in colour, I guess an artist's got to be able to improvise to that degree materially to encompass some of those issues to do with black and white.
I guess why I read quite a bit of white Australia into it is because I associate the language of the wool industry of that period and wool classing entirely with white Australia. So it almost goes against my expectations in a way for it to then realise that the words that you're drawing from are the words of an Australian man who did have Indigenous background and yet was working in the wool industry. I guess that's why my expectations are that it is referring to the language of white Australia, white rural Australia.
Oh yeah, that's the irony in the work too, is that on the Western Plains, the fierce battles that occurred in the 1830s and when the pastoralists were taking up those lands around Bathurst to Baraba and all that area there, Indigenous people were being forced off the land, and that the water was being, you know, water sources had been denied to them and access around properties, and there was very violent confrontation. So it is interesting that it was the sheep at that time that displaced Indigenous people, were Adjari and Gamilaroi people all over the Western Plains. It was the sheep industry that, I guess, the MacArthur Onslows and those people introduced to Australia, which made the place rich. When you examine Raymond's text, you find really subtle things that talking about them and they all the way through, and there's a sort of resistance sitting there in the lingo, what I call the lingo, where we were watching very closely to see how the structure of his expressions were sat on the page. So in a way, if you examine a text and the voice in the text, which I'm very interested in, from poetic points of view, musical points of view, there are markers there that indicate some schism. I guess there would be divisions between black and white or all those tones in between, which are yellow, red and grey. Sorry. Yeah.
Pieces.
They wanted their machines to run.
Which they'd have to scour it out.
As smoothly as possible.
As it's a mix.
They want
and short
good length.
They don't get good
they
prices
They want good
for
strength. They want good yields.
And by
well,
that I mean
one thing was
the fat on the wool. Lanolin.
Raises another issue. I'm not sure whether this is something that your work is dealing with at all, but on the other hand, the Aboriginal people did work very well, very effectively within Australia's rural industries, where they were incorporated into the industries as stockmen, as a wool classer in Raymond's example. But to a certain extent, Aboriginal people did become disenfranchised from those rural industries in the 60s when it became necessary to pay Aboriginal people the same wages that the white Australians were getting paid to do exactly the same job. Do you see some kind of irony there as well, in that the Aboriginal people became disenfranchised from those rural industries that they were so good at?
Well, that's well documented, and that is the case. And I do look at that disenfranchisement as the real culture of the stagnation, really, of Aboriginal economies in Australia. That in the northern part of the country, we know that there's trade routes between the Makassan and northeast and northwest Aboriginal communities all across the coastline there, and it's, there's evidence abounding in hundreds of years of trading backwards and forwards there. It's in the language, it's in the design, it's in the housing, it's in the paintings that we see in bark paintings and today and on rock paintings. There's lots of evidence of design issues that have just meshed together. So when the Europeans came to Australia, the Anglos, colonial project was really quite crude in comparison to maybe the German missioners that came to Central Australia. The issues to do with language was really quite strange. That that Aboriginal Australians were forced into a pidgin language, which would mark even the lingo, so to speak, so that they couldn't proceed effectively into participating in the great wealth that the country was to develop. When we come to the emergency bill today, it's disenfranchisement of a different kind and a different day. You know, we know that there's enormous mining royalties that are collected on those lands. I don't know what the leaseholds mean in that case. I think that the royalties perhaps go to the government for the period of the lease. I can't see that as being an effective way maintaining an Aboriginal economy, and there was an Aboriginal economy in Australia, and so it's a hard thing. But an artwork can't necessarily maintain and articulate directly that. Or my artwork doesn't work in that way. I wanted it to be an allegorical condition that some people can read those signals in the work.
I'm also interested in the very local connection that the work has, in that it's in the Carriage Works venue, which is surrounded by the neighbourhoods of Redfern, Waterloo, which have a long association with Indigenous urban Australia. Do you see any conversation going on between your work and the neighbourhoods surrounding this place?
Well, this work seems to be isolated here in the building. I mean, symbolically, the Carriage Works and the railroads here at Redfern have been, there's a myth that there was a conduit for Aboriginal people travelling from the homelands into the city and back from the city to the homelands when they really, you know, people wanted to come in and earn income. They also worked for the railroads. But I've heard also, since we put this project up, you start to hear these whispers come through that, in fact, the Carriage Works was a fairly tough place to work in the 1950s. The tales are that, in the 60s, that immigrant workers here were treated pretty badly, and the discrimination often came, you know, was inherited through, you know, the working class people in the factories here. So I think probably Aboriginal people were probably in the 1950s and 60s, for instance, were fairly marginalised if they were working in the carriage works or in the railways, as I understand it, here in Redfern. That's interesting. You know, you put up a work and people start then to reflect and refer information to you as a consequence of maybe opening up that window, that doorway, which this work seems to be allowing people to start to remember and recall those stories. Jonathan's grandfather says that his father had actually worked here in the railroads and here in Redfern the generation before that. So there had been a long association perhaps in this area. His mother lives in Redfern. Rick Rue, who worked on the audio, he actually worked in the carriage works itself. So as a young man, he was in here, and he's telling me about, you know, pretty tough conditions that were occurring. And my family have worked in and out of Redfern, so I keep, in a way, not rather to overstress the point that you're making work, you know, addressing a Redfern issue. I think a lot of the works I do seem to be born here in Redfern. It's a really interesting environment to work in, a neighbourhood to work in Redfern. We've made some films and worked with the local school, Redfern Public School, when they needed some documentary film work done when the closure was going on. So there's a lot of, I find it a very stimulating area. Hopefully some of the work, you know, is directly absorbed into the public, you know, by, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Ifsy Butts on the street, as I call them, every man. You know, it's a sort of hard, sometimes in art, it's a hard thing to know if you can get it beyond its, you know, sort of sanctuary.
And finally, much of your work does draw on historical references, and often you're uncovering interesting corners of Australian history. Do you in any way want to... Do you see anything of the historian in your work? Are you actually seeking out interesting or almost forgotten corners of Australian history that you then want to bring to light to the public?
Well, I think with Raymond, that's very much the case, you know, that he has a history which he's not necessarily comfortable about articulating and probably never thought about how to bring out the story. You know, his grandson is much more interested in those narratives and, you know, those heroic narratives of the 19th century and the resistance and the warrior, the political ramifications 200 years later. And, you know, working with Giles in Central Australia, there were poetic threads there that I could reconnect and weave in my own sort of artistic way the same. A lot of the times I'm interested in something that's not visible and trying to transcribe it, trying to move it, transfer it, illuminate it in a way. So I think if I can open windows and shine light through to things that we wouldn't normally think in those configurations, I get a lot of fun playing with those puzzles. A lot of people say the work is quite puzzling, but a lot of the time you find the audience is articulating it for the first time. You can hear them speaking the words, or they're going with the nonsense text, or some of the work is actually nonsense. It's not fully narrative, and so there's the narrative works, and then there's abstract concrete poems, and then there's absolute works, which I'm working on a piece at the moment called Silence, an Index of Silence, for instance. There's a whole range of different strategies that I might use to uncover things, and I guess those invisible parts of history. Last year I'm dealing with the revisionists' view of Australian history and correcting of the of Henry Reynolds' writing, or by Keith Windschuttle, and that debate that was going on was pretty...
Which is the so-called history wars that's going on in Australia, and the so-called black armband view of Australian history.
Yeah, I did this... I wrote a paper for a conference in Melbourne called Fighting the Philistines, and the culture wars Howard. Well, the culture war was something that Howard brought from the history wars first, and that was Keith Windschuttle and the right wing journalists. But at a later stage, to commemorate the 50 years of Quadrant magazine, the Prime Minister gave a speech which was what he called a culture wars. And so I thought that at this stage, you know, in October last year, things had become very extreme in Australian politics. We'd lurched really far to the right. We've even gone further in the last 6 months, but elections are terrific things for galvanising sort of polls apart. But, so I think it's a very good time for historians and artists to really be commenting on the histories, reinterpreting them. Indeed, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, and it's remarkable. We don't have the genre of history is not really discussed really openly in Australia, in the arts. It's a sort of in contemporary art. It's a rare thing.
On that note, thanks very much for talking to us today, Ruark.
Yeah, thank you.
As a wool classer, nowadays you they measure the all that
off the sheep
with the diameter,
like all the rough bits off
microns.
That's called piece.
But you
picking.
Measure all that.
After it goes through.
So you know how much
and
you can get out of it.
At which point
they send it out. Take a sample
where various
of the wool
countries
from the bales.
From all round
by
the place.
Putting like a small
look
tube
it over
in where they want
to buy
it
at auctions.